Well, last month, for the second time, I had to do what is one of the most difficult things for a parent to do. Lend my child money. No, that's not it. I had to take one of my children and drop them off somewhere and leave them. That is, without question, one of the most challenging things that we have to do as parents. Granted, this time, thank the Lord, it was in Greenville, not at the airport in Raleigh, to send one of my children halfway across the country to basic training. But still, that's a really, really hard moment for a parent. Of course, it's hard because you're going to miss them. It's a disruption to your life, your routine, the things that you've built. But it's also difficult because you worry about, to one degree or another, you worry about what they're going to face, what they're going to deal with, what the challenges that they're going to have. You worry about the decisions that they're going to have to make and maybe the mistakes that they'll make. So it's an extremely difficult time for a parent. You want them to avoid mistakes. You know the things you did when you were in that situation, and you don't want them to do that. You want them to avoid bad consequences. You want them to live their best life, and eventually you want them to go to heaven. And so you're very concerned about leaving them and letting them go from the shelter of your home, the protection of your home, the guidance that you've provided when they've been with you. This is a very challenging moment. The book of Leviticus was written at sort of a moment like that, when Moses was preparing to drop his kids off at the threshold of Canaan. When Moses was leading the Israelites and he was readying them to go into Canaan, that we know would, and I don't know what he knew and when in the writing of the books, but we know that when that happened, he would be going, or they would be going in, without him. They would be entering an environment that was pure wickedness. They would be entering an environment of sexual immorality, no moral standards, lots of substance abuse, lots of domestic sin and other kinds of wickedness, violence. So many ways that they could be hurt. They would be doing it without his help. And they would be doing it as people prone to evil. They would be doing it as people who, even when they're out in the wilderness, out in the middle of nowhere, where you would think there wasn't a lot of trouble to get into, the Israelites were constantly getting into trouble. And so Moses is worried about them. He feared for them. He's concerned about them. And so he's giving them instruction about how to avoid evil and how to live the very best life that they can. And that is the context, the broad context of Leviticus 18 and verses 1 through 5. This is our text for this morning as we finish up our series on blessings of obedience. You may or may not remember, last week I said I was going to do something out of Romans. Instead, as I began looking at it again, I realized that I was taking it out of context. And I thought, oh my lands, I can't do that. And so I need to find something else. And I did, and so I'm going to take this passage out of context instead. So Leviticus 18 and beginning in verse 1 is our text. As we go through it, notice, if you will, what is being emphasized. What is it that stands out to you in Leviticus 18 beginning in verse 1? What is it that stands out to you as really important principles that Moses is getting across? What stands out as something that is applicable to you? Something that you need to hear. Leviticus 18 and verse 1. Moses writing says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes, to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments, by which a man may live if he does them. I am the Lord. Now, no surprise to you that there are, guess how many things stand out to me in that passage? Three. Three things stand out to me in that passage. I am the Lord, keeping the statutes of God, and the result of keeping those statutes, and that is, God says, life. So we're going to talk about this morning, why does God repeat that He is the Lord? Why is it that He constantly drills into them, do what I say? And what does He mean that we will live if we do so? And what does all of this have to do with us? This was written by Moses hundreds of thousands of years ago to the Israelites, people who spoke a different language, men who wore dresses, people that don't live the way that we do. Okay, so that's still applicable to some, I guess. But what does this have to do with us? What does this have to do with our relationship with God? Let's begin with His emphasis on the Lord who is speaking. Notice in verse 1, the Lord spoke. And when the Lord spoke, what did He say? I am the Lord. And when you get down into the passage, He said it again. I am the Lord your God. And then before it's over, He said it again. I am the Lord. Why does He do that? Why does He do that? First of all, what does it tell you that He does? Is that important that He does it? Did He forget that He said it? Is this something that is just, He needs to fill space? You know, like when you get an assignment in English class and the teacher says, I want 200 words on the meaning of the grapes of wrath. And you're able to pound out 10. And so you got to fill it in with a bunch. Is that what God is doing, filling space? Why does He keep repeating this, that He is the Lord? Well, I believe it's for the same reason that very often we dads will repeat a similar thing. When we tell our children something and they say, why? Or how come? Or I don't get it. Or why do I have to do that? And we will respond to them, because I am your father. That's why. Why do we say that a lot? If you know, if your parents or your children are young, like very young, or you don't have children yet, I know what you're thinking. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be the kind of parent who says, because I said so and because I'm your dad. I know that you're thinking that, and I'm going to let you think that. And then I'm going to talk to you when your kids are about 3 and see how that really went, because I did that too. But this is what we do. Why do we do that? Why do we say to our children, because I'm your father, that's why? Why do we do that? Well, part of the reason, of course, is because it means we have authority. Part of the thing that children need to understand is that parents have authority. Parents have the right to say, this is what we're going to do. And children need to understand that. But I think it means more than that. When I tell my children, because I'm your father, that doesn't just mean I have the right to tell you what to do. It also means I'm telling you what to do because I love you. It also means I'm telling you what to do because I know some things that you do not know. I have some knowledge and wisdom you don't have. And because I'm your father, you should listen to me. When God says, I am the Lord, it means that He has authority. What do you think, if you had to say, what in our culture, in our world, what is happening with attitudes toward authority in our culture? If you had to describe the direction or the changes that are taking place in our culture when it comes to attitudes toward authority, how would you describe that? What would you say is happening? Would you say that people in our culture are gaining respect for authority? Would you say that people in our culture are more willing to follow rightful authority today or less so? What would your response to that be? I think we all understand when we look around And we see things like this headline from a business website, "Because I Said So, Why Top-Down Management Doesn't Work," or 10 Vital Tips on How to Recover from Authoritarian Parenting. Right? If your parents acted like they were an authority, here's what you need to do to get over that. Right? Well, mine did, and so any clues about that would be great. 5 ways you're managing your millennial employees all wrong. In other words, you think that as the employer or the boss or the manager, you think you have a right to tell folks how that's going to go. Well, guess what? These days you don't. These days it's all about doing it their way. This headline that talks a little bit about sports coaching, beyond autocratic leadership, not just telling people what to do. And I think this really interesting thing that we've seen in American Catholicism for a very long time, this headline that most Catholic Americans disagree with hardline positions of church leadership. Now, isn't that interesting? That in the Catholic Church, church leadership is considered to be divinely authoritative. And yet most American Catholics say, "I don't agree with that. I think that's wrong. And I see it a different way." In our culture, attitudes toward authority are going the wrong way. Attitudes toward authority are getting less respectful and less obedient. That cannot help but bleed over into people's view of God. It cannot help but occur that as children lose respect for parents, employees lose respect for bosses, players lose respect for coaches, it cannot help but happen that people will lose respect for God. And that's exactly what's happening. And yet, we have a book in the Bible like Job that spends 42 chapters making one point. You know what the point of Job is? Who are you to question me? That's the whole point of the book of Job. 42 chapters of weird dialogue, strange events, irritating characters, to get to the end and learn that the point of the book of Job is, who are you to question God? I posted this morning on Facebook a brief statement that for the Christian, when God says, "Because I said so," that's enough. And I had a Christian disagree with me. I had a Christian say that that was not right. It is not enough that God says, "I said so." But make no mistake, when God is saying to His people, "Here's what I want you to do, and by the way, in 5 verses, I want to tell you 4 times I'm the Lord," part of that is authority. Part of that is also love. Part of that is also love. An authoritative figure who does not love those who are subordinate to him or her is a disaster. I'll say that again. An authoritative figure that does not love those under them is a disaster. We know this from history. We know it from personal experience. I grew up around and worked briefly in social work, government agencies dealing with families in crisis. For 20 years, I was around that world. For 30 years or so, I have worked with young people in teaching some and coaching a lot. And I have seen over all of those years the effects of authority without love. I've seen the effects of parents who are in charge. They have authority. They're in control. They're telling people how to do it. But they're abusive. They're neglectful. They're unloving. They're absent. I've seen the effects of that. substance abuse, anger, violence, failure at school, sadness, depression, cutting, suicide. Why? Because these are people exposed to authority figures with no love. God has authority, but God also has perfect love. And then what I think is the third point of the triangle, when it comes to essential needs for blessing. If we want to be blessed, we must find someone who has authority, someone who loves, and someone who knows what they're doing. When I grew up playing sports, there was, with the exception of one coach I had playing baseball who was a hippie. His name was Willie, and he had hair down to the middle of his back, and he was fantastic. I loved him. He said man every other word. It was the 70s. I wasn't doing that yet, but when I got Willie as a coach, I started saying man every other word, and I've done it ever since. I love it. With the exception of my hippie coach, Willie, all the coaching that I ever got was of the sort of coaching you think of when you think about coaching. Yelling, demanding, right? Bearing down, name calling. That's the kind of coaching I got. Grabbing a face mask, grabbing a shirt. That's the kind of coaching I got. So naturally, when I started coaching, guess what I did? I did the same thing, minus the grabbing the face mask. I did the same thing. That was the sort of coaching I did. Yelling, stomping, that sort of thing. And so I remember one day I was at practice, and I had the players running laps before practice, which was always a lot of fun. It's always a lot of fun to start practice last, makes the kid cry right off the bat. It's a lot of fun. So I was making the kids do laps, and I'm absolutely blistering these kids. Not running hard enough, not coming in fast enough. And so I'm just screaming at these kids. Have a kid come, one of my favorite players, one of the best players I had. He's bawling his eyes out, crying like a baby. His dad was a team doctor. I said, what's the matter with him? I've never seen him do this. He said, the yelling is killing him. He said, he doesn't respond to that. He doesn't like that. That doesn't help him. That makes him want to quit. Well, naturally, he was my center and one of my fullbacks. I couldn't have him quitting, and so I had to stop yelling. But what I didn't understand was that I had the authority, I loved the kids, but my knowledge of coaching was lacking. There are other ways to do it than what I knew at the time. And I learned something. And so God has perfect knowledge. God has authority, but he loves and he knows what he's doing. And so he says to Israel in Leviticus 18, now notice two things. There's a negative and a positive. The negative is, you shall not do what? Now I think this is interesting. Don't miss this. In verse 2, notice what he says. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt. Now why would they have done that? That's where they lived. They were surrounded by it. But they had come out of that. So he says, don't do what they did there. Now you're coming out of there and you're coming into Canaan over here, and what? Don't do what they do either. I don't want you to do what they did, and I don't want you to do what they do. In other words, that culture got it wrong because they were doing it their way. That culture is different. They're getting it wrong. Even though it's different, they're still getting it wrong. It doesn't matter what culture you're in. As long as you live in this world, they will never get it right. Never get it right. And what we've got to be careful about is that we start making decisions based on the world around us. You cannot underestimate the strength of the culture that you live in. We think we don't do it, but we do. Do you realize that if my daughter, to this day, if my daughter does something nice for you, and you say to her, thank you, you know what she'll respond to you? My pleasure. You know why? Because she worked at Chick-fil-A for a long time. And when you work at Chick-fil-A, you don't say you're welcome or thank you or have a nice day or howdy. What do you say? My pleasure. We laugh every time it happens. She still says it. You can't underestimate the strength of the culture that you're in. When I was a teenager, I worked at Burger King for $1.85 an hour. I don't want to hear complaints about pay. I worked for $1.85 an hour, came home stinking and reeking of hamburger grease every night for $1.85 an hour, but I'm over it. But I worked at Burger King, and I worked a lot. And one, I never missed church for working there. Thank God I was able to make that happen. Very glad about that. But one Wednesday, I was working before church. So I worked, got off of work, went with my greasy hat head to church, and I had the opening prayer. And I stood up to do the opening prayer, and I was within a whisper of saying, "Welcome to Burger King. May I take your order, please?" I literally opened my mouth and went, "What? Our Father in heaven." It was almost bad, right? But that was the culture I was in. I was surrounded, and I said that time after time, day after day, and it became part of my thinking. We like to tell ourselves that we're not that way. We like to tell ourselves that we are independent thinkers, that we're doing things our way, that we're not giving into the culture. But I wonder, how many things, how many aspects of the house that we woke up in this morning, how many things do we do with our houses that we do because, well, if we didn't, what would the neighbors think? Right? The clothes that you're wearing. Right? We wear the clothes that we wear because, I mean, we get a little individuality every now and then, but how many of us would wear something that would make most people look at us and go, "Ugh, what's up with that?" Who would do that? Okay, occasionally I do that, but I don't mean to. But who would do that? Right? We worry about what other people say. To what degree the car that you drive, to what degree do other what other people think? Are there cars that you would be caught dead driving because of what other people would think? We think that we're living and thinking independently. But with so many things, we're worried about what other people think. And what he says to them in verse 2 is, you are surrounded by wickedness in Egypt. You're going to be surrounded by wickedness in Canaan. Don't do what they do. Now here's what you and I have been thinking for the past 3 years. What you and I have been thinking for the past 3 years is that 2020 is when it all went to garbage. We're sitting around thinking 2020. 2020 is the year when it all went downhill. 2020 is when everything went crazy. Boy, but before, you know what? Before 2020, it was just as messed up. Before 2020, the world was just as corrupt, just as wicked. So, oh man, if we could go back to the 80s. Anybody remember the 80s? Oh, if we could just go back to the 70s. If we could go back to the 50s with Leave It to Beaver. Everything would be fine. Do you realize that in the 50s, everything was just as messed up? The culture was just as godless. It won't matter if this election cycle, if your man or woman, whoever that is, in this election cycle, if your man or woman is elected and gets their way, it's still not going to fix the culture. It will still be wicked. It will still be ungodly. It will still be other than what God wants it to be. And even if your man or woman wins and gets all the changes they want to make, God would still say to us, don't do what they do. Don't talk like they do. Don't dress like they do. Don't live like they do. Instead, what? God says, instead, do what I tell you to do. Now, if you will do that, what does God say? The third thing in our outline for this morning, what does he say? I am the Lord, do what I tell you, and if you will do that, what will happen? He says in Leviticus chapter 18 and in verse 5, you will live. Well, what does that mean? In the context of Leviticus 18, what did he mean when he said, you will live if you will obey me? Well, several things, actually. First of all, he meant, I mean, you'll avoid the death penalty. That's part of it. Because they had a lot of laws that carried the death penalty. And so one thing that God means is, if you do what I tell you, they won't take you out and stone you. That's one thing. He also means, if you will do what I tell you, I will not bring famine and hail and other nations against you and kill a bunch of you. That's also what he means. He also means, if you will do what I tell you, you will live a healthier life, you will live a safer life, and you will live longer. You won't die so young if you'll do what I tell you. Those three things, I think, are the main things that God was getting across to his people. But as I was putting this together, I thought, is that really all? Is that really all of it? Is life about just not having the bad thing? Is that enough? And I realized that, of course, it wasn't. And as I looked into the New Testament, what I realized was that God is also saying here that if you will do what I say, you will have eternal spiritual life. You will have an amazing life here, and you will have eternal life in heaven as well. And so I think it should be pretty obvious what all of this has to do with us. Let's just look briefly at that, and then we will be done. What does it mean for us that God is the Lord? What it means is that he has all authority. It is our job as Christians to read the Bible and to do what it says. Period. It also means that God loves us and that his will is good for us because he knows what is best for us. When he says to keep his statutes, he means that obedience is required and that when we do his will, we will have physical and spiritual life. But you know that not everyone agrees with that. Not everyone agrees that obedience is required. To a lot of people, obedience sounds very Old Testament. And so, for the rest of our time, what I would like to do is just simply touch on Romans chapter 2. We're not going to do this for very long. Romans chapter 2 and verses 2 through 11. And what you will notice in Romans chapter 2 in verses 2 through 11 is that Paul, at the very beginning of the book of Romans, which is the most, and I think you'll know what I mean when I say this, Romans is the most New Testament book in the Bible. Romans is the most New Testament, faith-heavy book in the Bible. And at the beginning of it, guess what he emphasizes? The importance of obedience. Notice in verses 2 and 3. In verses 2 and 3 in Romans 2, he talks about the importance of what you practice. In verses 3, 7, 9, and 10, he uses the words do, doing, and does. In verse 6, he talks about our deeds. And in verse 8, he uses the word obey. That's why he can say in verse 11, there is no partiality with God. You see, the only way for God to save or condemn impartially is based on the life that you live, the things that you do. That's the only way to be impartial. Martin Luther King, 60-ish years ago, said, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." Do we live in that world? Not even close. We do not live in that world. We live in a world where it matters if your name is Elon Musk or Eddie Hutchinson. It matters. It matters if you live in Manhattan or Newport. It matters. It matters a lot if you are a governor or a janitor. Those things matter in our world. But God, he says, judges impartially. With God, it is not about your color. With God, it's not about your bank account, your job title, your last name, who your family is, how long they've been in the church, what churches they established, what churches they eldered at. It doesn't matter. With God, according to Paul in Romans 2, it is about the things that you do. And so when we do the things that are right, he says in Romans 2, actually we'll look at verse 9 of Romans 2. Romans 2, 9, there will be tribulation, distress for every soul of man who what? Who does evil. Of the Jew first and also the Greek. Now notice verse 10. But glory, honor, peace to everyone who what? Does good. To the Jew first and also to the Greek. It matters what you do. The Bible is clear that the life that God blesses is the life of obedience. It does not have to be perfect. It will never be perfect. But the question that each of us need to ask ourselves is, the things that we've talked about this morning. Before we do that, let me just mention that next week, Lord willing, we're going to begin on Sunday morning a five-part series. We have five Sundays in the month, five lessons on how to study the Bible. And then tonight, Lord willing, we'll be back here at 6 o'clock. It is our regular Bible study Sunday night. And we're going to begin what will be a pretty deep dive into the second coming of Jesus in the letters of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. And so that's what we have upcoming. For now, we will take out our song book. Aubrey, what was it again? 480. Number 480. We will sing that song in just a moment. Number 480. And as we do, we will ask you to think carefully about what we have talked about this morning. Do you know God as the Lord? Do you believe? And do you live His absolute authority? Do you believe? And do you live the love that He has for you? Do you believe that God knows what is best for you? And believing in His authority, trusting in His love, knowing He knows what's best, do you obey His will? It will never be perfect. But is it your ultimate goal every day when you get up in the morning to say, whatever God wants me to do, moment by moment today, that's what I will do. When I don't do it, I will confess. I will repent. And I will try to do better. Is that the life that you live? If you're not a Christian, having committed to that, we'd love to help you become a Christian and start living that way. If you are a Christian and you're struggling with something this morning that's keeping you from that, and it's something that you need help with, we want to help. We'd love to talk with anybody privately after church, or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.